Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by GlaxoSmithKline, we pass the mic to Bradley J. Monk, MD, FACS/FACOG, U.S. Oncology Medical Director of Gynecologic Oncology Research and Professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and Maury Markman, MD, Physician and President of Medicine and Science at Cancer Treatment Centers of America, and the Editor-in-Chief of our flagship publication, Oncology Live, to discuss the evolution of treatment in advanced ovarian cancer and provide perspective on the current utility of PARP inhibitors as frontline maintenance therapy. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Monk and Dr. Markman discussed the rationale behind maintenance therapy, pivotal PARP inhibitor trials in the frontline setting, and the importance of shared decision-making.
So greetings and welcome. My name is Brad Monk. I'm a gynecologic oncologist here in Phoenix, Arizona. And I am so excited to be here with my friend and mentor, Dr. Maury Markman. Maury, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Maury Markman. Pleasure to be here with you. A mentor makes me older. We are long-term colleagues, greatly respectful of each other. And I'm a medical oncologist, involved in the area of gynecologic cancers now for over 35 years. I'm delighted to be with you all.
Yeah, this is really exciting. So as you know, Dr. Markman, I'm going to call him Maury because he is my friend and colleague, but he has created the lexicon in ovarian cancer. He has explored intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and he has explored maintenance. And so I first met him when he was mentoring me on this maintenance idea of GOG-178. Maury, tell us about GOG-178 and sort of what the idea was of maintenance therapy in newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer.
Yeah, Brad, that's history. And of course, many medical oncologists, gynecologic oncologists don't sort of remember that history. It goes back before 178. We knew that ovarian cancer was a disease where there was a very, very high response rate to platinum-based chemotherapy. That's, 40 years. We also knew that when you stop therapy in the vast majority of patients, the disease came back. There were ideas that, why don't you just continue therapy? Well, everyone knows what happens with platinum. Not only is the nausea and vomiting an issue, but you obviously have problems with further bone marrow suppression. You obviously have problems with neuropathy. So a variety of approaches have looked at, 4 or 8 cycles of platinum or 5 or 10 cycles of platinum, whether it's carboplatin pack or cisplatinum, it didn't work. It didn't work because the toxicity, you really couldn't get the therapies in. And so that idea fell by the wayside. But, it was never disproven that giving additional therapy as a maintenance approach to maintain that response didn't work. We just didn't have the right drug. So along comes paclitaxel, again, many years ago, and here was an interesting drug. It was a drug that didn't have the bone marrow suppressive effects, for example, of a cyclophosphamide or a carboplatin for that matter. Clearly, it didn't have the nausea and vomiting. We didn't have evidence of secondary acute leukemias. We did, of course, have the evidence of neuropathy, but the idea was that maybe if you gave the therapy maybe once a month over a period of time, perhaps you could maintain that response. So the idea behind this strategy was a phase 3 randomized trial conducted by Southwest Oncology Group, the Gynecologic Oncology Group, with Brad as a co-PI. They're very simple. To give a year, once a month, single agent paclitaxel versus a control arm of 3 months. Time doesn't allow us to talk about why we didn't have a no treatment control, but it was pragmatic. And to see if it made a difference. And what we showed was a highly statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival, so much so that the Data Safety Monitoring Committee stopped the study and with about half of the accrual, but showing a major improvement in PFS. The end result, because the patient population was a little bit too small, we could not show a difference in overall survival. But very importantly, we had a lot of toxicity. As anticipated, what we saw was the neuropathy. But this was the first indication that extending therapy in a patient who respond could have an impact on the time to disease progression.
So that was brilliant. And I love that. And thank you for taking me under your wing. I was the GOG, PI. Obviously, it was a SWOG-led trial. So I went back to the drawing board because it worked. In fact, as you said, the Data Safety Monitoring Committee stopped it early because it was so great, but it wasn't really that great. And along came bevacizumab. So working with Bob Berger and also the GOG, we launched GOG 218, 218, published it in the New England Journal in 2011 and got it FDA approved in 2018, but it wasn't that good. In fact, if you remember, the paclitaxel extension in PFS was 7 months and the PFS extension for bevacizumab was 6.2 months. So paclitaxel actually was a little bit more efficacious. It was good, it got FDA approved, but it wasn't good enough. And so but you taught me that more. You taught me that maintenance treatment was an option. And then along came PARP inhibitors. And there was this wonderful, amazing, another New England Journal paper called SOLO-1. Tell us about SOLO-1 now.
Yeah, SOLO-1 was a really remarkable study. Obviously, now it's well known in the community, but this was almost would have been anticipated, not the magnitude of benefit, but anticipated based upon the second line strategies that have already been looked at with olaparib. But this was basically straightforward chemotherapy. And with patients who responded, either would get olaparib as a single agent or a placebo. And the study demonstrated a remarkably impressive improvement in progression-free survival in favor of the olaparib maintenance. But even much so that the median PFS wasn't even reported at the time of the study. It was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine and publicly reported. It looked at 3-year progression-free survival as a endpoint prospectively defined, again, showing a major advantage and an impressive plateau on the curve, PFS curve, which needs to be followed up. But the magnitude of the benefit, the prolongation of no progression was just something that had not been seen before.
Unprecedented. And it was tolerable because it was oral. And we could admit, and the beauty of a PARP inhibitor, right, is you take it, and if it causes a problem, you don't take it the next day. Yeah. It's not like paclitaxel where you take it and you have to suffer through the neuropathy for the entire month. It was sort of a transformation in what you invented, Maury. Maintenance treatment, but we just needed to find the right medication. Bevacizumab was an incremental step in the right direction, but SOLO-1 was really unprecedented, but it was only for BRCA patients.
Right.
So either germline BRCA, which is about maybe 17%, and somatic BRCA, which was maybe another 7 or 8. So only a quarter of the patients. Then we sort of hit the fourth trial, PRIMA. And PRIMA was an all-comer population, high-risk patients taking niraparib. And we personalized the dose over time with niraparib that if you were underweight or had a low baseline platelet count, you started at 200 rather than 300. And then ultimately it began to work in all populations. BRCA, patients with BRCA-like mutations, which we call HRD, or even non-BRCA. That begins to beg the question, is it a PARP inhibitor for all newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer maintenance, or is it only for BRCA, like SOLO-1 showed, or is it only for HRD, or is it everyone? And that's really the key point of our conversation here, Maury. And I'm so excited to hear your opinion here.
My perspective on this will probably shock many, but basically I agree with the FDA. And that is they have, at least early in the case of the RAPA data, have opined that it's not their decision to make. I think one can very easily say that, the greatest benefit was in the BRCA mutation positive patient population, which is true statistically. On the other hand, there was benefit in the other patient population, and that the FDA said that is now between the doctor and the patient, and presumably the patient's advisors, usually the family members, but it could be others, to make that determination of whether the benefits that have been seen in the trial within a population of patients makes a difference to them as to whether they would like that maintenance strategy now. Because obviously, we also can say that potentially you could take it later if the disease were to come back. But I think to me, it's really comes down to that discussion between the doctor and the patient. It is, of course, easiest in the BRCA mutation patient population because just as in SOLO-1, the benefits seen in terms, again, median PFS, prolonged PFS, potentially plateauing of a curve, with no data yet on overall survival, is most impressive in the population that had the mutation. But it was observed statistically in a population, even in the absence of that particular mutation. And the reason, of course, is there are other defects in DNA repair.
Yes.
Some of which we understand, some of which you don't understand, which PARPs are favorably impacted.
So you said two interesting things. And so there's this new term, shared decision-making. You says it's between the patient and the doctor.
Yeah.
The other thing, I'd love talking to you. So the other thing you said is that you're trying to convert sort of a population statistic to an individual. And there are some patients that really do well, even though they don't have HRD, which we call homologous recombination proficient. In fact, if you look at the hazard ratio in that HRP population, it looks about the same as bevacizumab and paclitaxel. So it was a hazard ratio of 0.68. So I get it. I don't really know. We can't really say what every patient needs. But this is what one of my colleagues says. They say, you know, Brad, that may be the only time that patient with homologous recombination proficiency, no mutations, can get access to an on-label PARP inhibitor. Have you heard that argument, Maury?
And I think the other point to be made, again, very pragmatic, is that these are oral agents.
Yeah, there you go.
And orals are great if you can take oral. And of course, as we all know, you better than I, because you're a surgeon, Brad, is that when ovarian cancer comes back, it often, where it comes back, is in the abdominal cavity / the digestive system. And, you know, if you had a parenteral preparation, you could say, oh, we could use it later. That may not be true. Again, that's a pragmatic, you can't predict the future, but I can't use an oral drug. So that's another issue.
That's great. And so now, you know, we talked about 178, 218, SOLO-1, PRIMA, now the fifth trial is PAOLA-1 giving bevacizumab and olaparib together, the combination, the first positive combination. And, you know, I don't know if you, I'm sure you saw that bevacizumab atezolizumab was negative. So it's not that easy, right? So you can't just do any combination that's going to work. But this bevacizumab olaparib combination also got FDA approved on May 8th, but only in the HRD population. And there were two challenges. Number one, there was no olaparib alone arm. And the other challenge was, quite frankly, that it was mostly done in Europe because we didn't have bevacizumab approved at the time. And so you have to use bevacizumab to use the combination, and you have to order a molecular test in order to see if there's the molecular signature. So it becomes more complicated. Do you think that the combination is a viable option, or are these drugs better, you know, used in sequence rather than, and we'll never know. Trust me, we'll never know. And I've been waiting to ask you that question because I think you're the smartest guy.
No, you know, I wish I controlled the world and could have said, well, I wish the trials had been designed differently, and I wish we had head-to-head comparisons, because it's a very important question. Of course, there are ongoing trials. There are trials with other drugs with a combination of bevacizumab. And, you know, we'll be able to look at those. But today, what we have is what we have. And it's wonderful the trials are positive, but you're literally asking an unanswerable question because we don't have head-to-head comparison. And people have tried, not inappropriately, to try to, well, if we let's just see if we can line up this population or that population and do some statistical analyses to see if it makes a difference. All well and good, but we know the reason we do randomized trials is so we don't have to do that, what I just said. And I guess my statement is, it's a conversation with the patient, the doctor, and the practice. I very much support the data in general and in specific regarding bevacizumab. I've used it. I'm comfortable with it. I think patients are comfortable with it. That's an opinion now. And so I would say, you know, it's not unreasonable to consider the combination of bevacizumab with olaparib in this case, and bevacizumab with one of the other drugs. Whereas another oncologist may say in the frontline setting, you know, I'm not absolutely convinced about bevacizumab. We haven't shown it has an impact on survival, as you said. I could use bevacizumab later. We know that it works in every line of therapy. I want to focus on the PARP inhibitor, and I can't say they're wrong.
Right.
But I would say is, you know, I would discuss that with the patient.
The decision for the combination, a lot of it comes down to bevacizumab, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that was a really nice distillation. I think it also comes down to testing, right? Because it's a tumor test.
It's another test you have to discuss. You have to discuss it with the patient. You know, absolutely. It's one more added component of the discussion. Absolutely.
So that's wonderful. I think probably the only clear message here is that no maintenance is a bad idea.
I would say is, you know, again, going back to the 178, I think it was a nice idea. The drug we had is the drug we had. It showed an important principle. But painful to say, but ovarian cancer is a really bad disease, and particularly when it comes back. And I don't know if we're going to cure patients in frontline therapy with PARP inhibitors. I believe there's a possibility of that. But even if we don't, even if long-term, meaning when we get the data a year, year and a half now, we show those curves come together, to add a year, to add 2 years, to add 3 years, to add 4 years where that patient doesn't have recurrent disease and their quality of life is that good, I think that's an absolute victory.
Yep. So I see people and they look at the adverse reactions associated with these trials and they say, look at that. And I say, yeah, that was for a day or two because they interrupted, they recovered, and they dose reduced. So the most sophisticated patient-reported outcomes that we have were utilized in all of these targeted therapies, bevacizumab, PARP, and the combination. And there was no decrement in quality of life.
That's right.
That doesn't mean there aren't adverse reactions, but those adverse reactions can be mitigated, again, with dose interruptions, dose reductions, even discontinuations when necessary, and also supportive care.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And you know, whether it's hematologic toxicities or the nausea is a very important one, because obviously oncologists are so used to the acute nausea and the intense nausea we see with platinums or doxorubicin. And, you know, it's really bad, it gets better. This is different because this is oral, this is every day. So you've got to be able to manage that. And you can't ignore it. You can't say it's only grade one. It's often the nurses that are the ones that work with the patients when they take the drug, what they tell they take it, what time of day they take it, whatever, eating with food in the mouth, which is food, it's good, it's okay, it's acceptable. So you got to work with that, but it's doable. Absolutely, it's doable.
Yeah, it's been a fun journey. And, you know, the gynecologic oncology investigators brought paclitaxel to, you know, solid tumor oncology. And now we brought PARP inhibitors. So PARP inhibitors, are, as you know, are approved in breast cancer, pancreatic, and prostate.
So, no, so you got to go back even further. The platinums were brought by that, yeah, by that community too.
Yeah, I guess that's
but
true.
Even earlier than that.
Yeah, there you go. So I want to thank you, Maury, for your lifetime commitment. Every day when I see a patient, you've impacted that landscape.
Well, thank you, Brad.
So I mean it, and it's been a personal sacrifice, but I think you've had fun. I'm going to give you the last word, and then we're going to wrap this up. So go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and to talk with you as part of a conversation about the care of patients. You are so committed, have been so committed your entire career, and obviously also particularly in the drug development area, which is my interest. It's been such a wonderful journey with you. And again, final statement is the impact I believe all of us have had on patients. We're all of us working together, including patients working with us, has been enormous, and their end results, as we are today moving forward, are incredibly positive, and the future looks very good for more advances. Thanks, Brad.
Well, thanks, Maury. Good seeing you, and so long for now.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by GlaxoSmithKline. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives on Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.